Hello there. This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and as a radio host, you might say, I have special powers.
Behold his mighty hand!
The wind opens the sea!
God opens the sea with the blast of his nostrils.
Hollywood parting the Red Sea. Well, Charlton Heston as Moses, anyway. This hour, the power of the Bible in the movies and the power of water. Water everywhere, come to think of it. Water often plays a big role on the big screen. Noah sails his ark in the movies this weekend. L.A. water was the star of the classic movie Chinatown, where investigator Jack Nicholson parts no Red Seas as he chases a water mystery in the middle of a drought.
Noah Cross worked for the water department.
He owned it.
How'd they get it away from him?
Mr. Mulray felt the public should own the water.
Okay, go home. But in case you're interested, your husband was murdered. Somebody has been dumping thousands of tons of water from the city's reservoirs, and we're supposed to be in the middle of a drought. He found out about it, and he was killed. It seems like half the city is trying to cover it all up, which is fine by me.
From the 1974 movie Chinatown, about life and death dramas of California water in the 1930s, to today, where there is a real drought emergency in that state and throughout the western states. And more broadly, water is at the center of conflicts around the world. 1.5 billion people deal with scarce water every day. Demand for water is growing twice as fast as the population worldwide. This hour, a look at water's impact on politics, culture, and the ways we live. We begin with David Sedlak, who tells us that the era of imported water from dams and reservoirs and elaborate pipeline networks may be ending. Sedlak is co-director of the Berkeley Water Center and author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource.
Well, in the early part of the 20th century, importing water from long distances was a viable strategy because you could share it with everyone who needed it. But as cities have continued to grow and agriculture has become more intensive, and we've come to recognize the need to leave more of that water in the environment to support ecosystems, there just isn't enough out there.
Looking at some of the deep history here, isn't it the case that some of the earliest laws that were ever written in the United States or elsewhere were all about who gets access to waterways, water systems, water supplies, who gets to touch somebody's well and who has to keep their hands off it, that sort of thing?
Well, if water is the essential ingredient for life, then a water supply is the essential ingredient for a civilization. And so we always look towards figuring out who has rights to water when we set up our cities. And so the modern era for really thinking hard about our water supply begins after the Second World War, in my opinion. That is, in that period, we had tremendous growth in the western United States and the mechanization of agriculture. So suddenly you needed a lot more water to supply people with everything that they needed for a growing economy.
Is water no longer a local concern in terms of dealing with the drought that the West is currently experiencing?
I think it's quite the opposite. Imported water just doesn't seem secure anymore. So now we turn back to thinking about local water supplies. And the developments in new technologies over the past 30 years makes it possible for large cities in the West to break their reliance on imported water from these huge federal projects. And the people who are furthest ahead in figuring out this problem of a local water supply are the people who are under the biggest stress. That is, the cities with the junior water rights who've grown after all the water in the West was claimed. And so you see places like Orange County, south of Los Angeles, or San Diego, where the imported water supply isn't secure in a time of a drought.
What is the difference between drought issues in the eastern states and what's going on in the West as you see it?
In the western United States, you always have this huge amount of water that's been dedicated for agriculture as a backstop if everything goes wrong. So cities at some level have the sense that if the drought gets bad enough, there will be water transfers from agriculture to cities. In the southeast and in places like Texas, there isn't always a large federal project that they can tap into if things get desperate. So in many ways, places like Tampa and Atlanta and Dallas and Odessa, Texas, are more vulnerable than the places that are in the news, like Los Angeles and San Francisco.
What can Texas do on its own? And does anyone still believe that you could run a pipeline from Lake Superior down I-35 and basically solve all the water problems in places like Texas and Oklahoma?
Texas can do a lot on its own, and it's starting to do a lot on its own. So, for example, last year, the water utility in a place called Big Spring near Odessa opened up a direct potable water recycling plant. That is, they started treating their sewage effluent and putting it directly into the drinking water reservoir. That project and a project in El Paso, which has been treating sewage effluent and using it to recharge the drinking water aquifer, are examples of the kinds of things that Texas can do to make for a more secure water supply in the future.
So how bad would you say this California drought is in terms of pushing the people of California and the West towards a real day of reckoning on water supply issues?
I think the worst impacts of the drought will be felt among the farmers, many of whom are just teetering on the verge of viability on the basis of the last few droughts. For the cities of California, it's a wake-up call, and it's a wake-up call and excuse to start thinking about where our water is going to come from in the next 20 or 30 years, because the kinds of water infrastructure projects that we're going to need to build to diversify our water supply don't get built overnight. And so even if this isn't a true crisis for California's cities, it's a great opportunity because with the continued population increase, with the effects of climate change, and with the need to use water sensibly in agriculture and to support the environment, the cities have to find another way.
David Sedlak is a professor and co-director of the Berkeley Water Center, author of Water 4.0, The Past, Present, and Future of the World's Most Vital Resource. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
All day I faced a barren waste without the taste of water.
Water scarcity produces opportunities for thugs, detectives, and lawyers, as was the story in Chinatown, the movie. But that's happening in reality right now all over the West. Courtrooms have become stages where the drama of water rights is being played out. Two lawyers now right in the middle of it all. Sarah Klon is a water rights lawyer based in Colorado, and Stuart Somach is a water rights lawyer in California. For both, water disputes mean steady work.
Lawyers who deal with water rights deal with it all the time, and because the West is naturally scarce in that resource, things are usually always busy. What drought does is create a kind of frenetic activity. I'll give you one example of one that the drought has definitely exacerbated, and that's an original action that I filed on behalf of the state of Texas against the states of New Mexico and Colorado on the Rio Grande. That finally culminated about a year ago in our filing an original action in the United States Supreme Court in order to ensure that Texas got its supply of Rio Grande water across the state line. The drought clearly was among the things that pushed the state into deciding that it needed to file the lawsuit to protect its sovereign interests.
Sarah Klon, what are you seeing in terms of plaintiffs, the level of intensity on these kinds of water-related contests?
We mainly represent cities and industries. So the cities come to us and they say, for example, we've spent X millions of dollars over the last 30 or 40 years to build a firm supply of water for our citizens and our water customers. And the groundwater pumpers want to pump the water without keeping the river whole. Essentially, the wells are connected to the river through the alluvium. So the cities will say, we need you to protect our water rights, or we're going to have customers who turn on the tap and discover there's no water or see massive increases in their water rates. You're looking at cities that have built a portfolio of water rights in order to be good stewards of the public, and they're being challenged by agricultural irrigators who either didn't plan or came to the game late, and it's an unfortunate fact of life that both sides have a lot to lose, but it's a zero-sum game.
And Stuart, would you say that the traditional antagonists are lining up here? Is it cities versus farmers versus industries, or is there a way for them to find some common ground on a scarce resource?
Well, historically, the dispute always used to be about agricultural interests versus urban interests, senior water rights versus junior water rights. One of the things that's changed over the years that I've practiced and makes this particular drought a little bit more interesting and more difficult to deal with is the fact that you have a third significant and major player in the fight, and that's the environment. That since the last large drought that we had in the 70s, and then we had another significant drought in the 90s, the amount of water that is dedicated to the environment, either through the Endangered Species Act or through other legal mechanisms, has increased greatly. And that has happened in California without any additional water supplies particularly being developed. The pie hasn't grown, but those folks taking water from the pie has increased. And as a consequence, the tension really is how do you provide water for cities and agriculture and still have enough water for environmental protection, and whether or not environmental concerns ought to also take some reduction in order to allow us to get through these drought periods.
So I'm hearing from both of you a takeaway that involves a possible rollback of traditional environmental set-asides for water as a way of providing more resource, and a possible penalty for those folks and institutions and cities that have planned well and have aggregated a supply going forward that suddenly is going to be reallocated. Is that how you see it, Sarah and Stuart?
We don't have as much of an environmental component to the water supply system here in Colorado. And I think it's more a question of how is that wrestle with this shortage situation that continues to grow more acute when everybody wants to maintain their existing status quo.
A sequel to Chinatown, Stuart?
Well, Chinatown was a situation where rural areas lost water to urban areas. And I think that what you have in California is this notion of the way you deal with a drought is you throw out all the rules and you let the regulatory agencies decide where the water is going to go, how it's going to go, and so forth. And that's what I worry about the most, is that because of this unique situation, instead of allowing a water rights doctrine that was born out of drought, born out of scarcity, work as it was intended to, the regulators will think that it's time to change the rules and do it the way they think is best, ignoring the fact that we have a whole system that is built upon certain rules, certain legal constraints that ought to be able to address the problem adequately.
Stuart Somach is a water rights lawyer based in California, and Sarah Klein is a water rights lawyer based in Colorado. Thanks to both of you.
You're very welcome.
Water, of course, has meaning for everyone.
My name is Michelle Sharman. I'm calling from Cupertino, California. My favorite body of water is Lake Otsego, which is in Gaylord, Michigan. And that lake was clean and clear. Little minnows would swim around our legs. My grandparents built themselves a little cottage across from the lake, and we had our own private little beach that we went to every summer.
A water dream from Daytona Beach, Florida. Here, the St. Johns River. I grew up right by it, fished it all the time. It brings up memories of my childhood, feeling for mussels with my toes and using them for bait. Our number 8778MyTake, tweet us at The Takeaway. Coming up, a look at how wealthy Russians are dealing with the shark-infested waters of sanctions. Stay with us. So let's say you are a Russian oligarch, safely in your yacht in international waters somewhere, and you're watching all the headlines about Crimea and the Ukraine crisis and sanctions imposed and threatened by the West. Assets frozen, sudden new competition for energy, the ruble crashing, natural gas prices unstable all of a sudden. You don't need a financial advisor anymore. You need a sanction-proof, crisis-proof portfolio and fast. Well, you know, those calls are going out just like the capital in Russia is flying out. And the answers the oligarchs are likely to get from enterprising bankers around the world tell the story of the strengths and weaknesses of the financial system and the Russian economy right now. Joining us is Ruchir Sharma, head of emerging markets at Morgan Stanley Investment Management and author of Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. Ruchir Sharma, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, good to speak with you.
So $70 billion of capital flight is expected over the next few months in Russia. Who's getting the call to park that money, and how would you go about getting around sanctions? And then what does that say about the threat of sanctions altogether?
Well, I think that, you know, like it's a really damning statement in terms of like the Russian economy. Because the key thing is this, that even before this crisis broke out in Ukraine, Russians were taking money out in droves. That in the last couple of years, they've been taking out $60 billion a year, which is the highest amount since the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. And in the first quarter of this year, that number has apparently jumped up to as high as $70 billion. So $60 billion a year, last 2 years, first quarter of this year, $70 billion. So like, obviously, there's a lot of concern about what's happening in the Russian economy. And these concerns go even before the crisis. And that's the key thing, because when the locals are taking money out of a country, that's usually a good rule to tell you that the domestic fundamentals aren't looking strong.
Is there anything that Russia can do to stop this capital? They've set up their own payments program to try to get around Visa and MasterCard. The ruble is pretty much convertible. There's no way they would go back to some sort of state-controlled currency, would they?
Well, I mean, like, nothing is off the table because events have been moving so quickly. But yeah, I mean, even if they were to impose capital controls, the we've seen from past experience, people always know how to take money out of a country when they really need to. So I don't think that would really help. I think that the only thing which would help is if the Russian economy begins to do a bit better. I mean, the fact is that the Russian economy's growth rate has collapsed to just over 1% last year. This year, it'll be lucky if it registers any growth at all. This is a far cry from the 7% type economic growth that Russia was registering every year for much of the last decade. So really, the only solution to this is if Russia's economic prospects get better. And given what's going on, I don't see the prospect for that.
Now, you're an emerging markets analyst at Morgan Stanley. I don't want to put you in a bind here. But before we talk about energy in just a moment, I mean, if you did have a couple billion that you wanted to park, I mean, can you call? Are there places you can call that will get you around sanctions and basically play this market, you know, actual banks that will help you with this sort of thing?
No, there's no restriction for investing in Russia today in terms of the level two sanctions, you know, which the U.S. has imposed, sort of places no restrictions on investing in Russia. It's only if things really escalate and they have level three sanctions would that come about. So today we can still invest in Russia if we want to. It's only if they move to the next level of sanctions, then we'd have to come, as you're saying, then people would start to sort of think of more innovative ways. But I don't see, I mean, the real issue there is that why would anyone want to put money into Russia if we get level three sanctions? But today there's no prohibition on that.
And there's plenty of people willing to help people get money out of Russia in the financial system.
Oh, yeah, in terms of the fact that that's always going on. As I said, that even before this crisis broke out, $60 billion a year was flowing out of the country. So that's something which can still happen.
In the energy department, you know, the fact that Russia will register almost no growth, even though they are a energy-rich country, really speaks volumes. Is it possible for the United States and Europe to develop a liquefied natural gas capability in Europe that would bypass Gazprom, the big energy company in Russia?
Yeah, these things take time. So I think that, yes, it's certainly possible. The events only of the past few weeks only incentivize that. But here's the really key thing, which I think people need to put in perspective here, which is that Russia needs as much of that oil revenue as Europe is, let's say, needs that Russian energy. I mean, this is a very codependent relationship, because I know the sort of fear which is made out there is that what will happen if the gas and like energy supplies are cut off to Europe. Europe, you know, like has one third of its such demand coming from Russia. But the key thing to remember is that Russia is very dependent on this in the fact that if you move the oil revenues out of the Russian budget, then the Russian budget, you know, gets into a deep deficit. It's becomes ever more reliant on foreign capital to fund its needs at home. So Russia needs these oil and like energy related revenues as much, if not more, then let's say Europe needs its energy from Russia.
So watch the energy markets to see signs of possible Russian blinking as this crisis goes forward. Ruchir Sharma, thanks so much.
Sure, enjoyed that.
Ruchir Sharma is head of emerging markets at Morgan Stanley Investment Manager. He's the author of Breakout Nation in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracle. From the shark-infested waters of finance to...
My name is Michelle Corbett. I am from Green Cove Springs, Florida. The Pacific Ocean, as a matter of fact. I spent several years on Midway Island as a small child. The beach was just over the dune from our house, and the water had more kinds of fish than you could possibly imagine. The creepy sea cucumbers, the stunning colors of the coral and the fish, and then, of course, there's the terrifying tiger shark.
years on Midway Island. Michelle, there's got to be more to that story.
This is Erin Hobach calling from Poplin Lakes. My favorite body of water is the Atlantic Ocean. I had a summer house where my two daughters and I would swim, dig for clams, see little tiny fish in the ocean and baby shark, and we would take walks sometimes for 5 miles in the sun and along the coast. And occasionally you could look up and see dolphins, and it was absolutely beautiful.
Here's another vote for the Pacific from Mountain View, California, off the Oregon coast. My family used to have a beach house in a little town, and we'd visit on many of our breaks. I nearly drowned in a sneak tide once. My uncle's ashes, he died young, were put there. It's a very spiritual, beautiful, and important place for me. That's a great story. From Bellevue, Washington, the favorite is Biscayne Bay off Miami, my hometown. My mom visited Miami Beach the day I was born. I learned to swim on South Beach, watched thunderstorms coming in over the bay all through school, and I always visit when I come back from Seattle, where there's plenty of water these days. Share your story at 877-8MYTAKE or at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
Boy, something nearly derailed the NCAA tournament yesterday, a big story that could change the status of all college athletes. The National Labor Relations Board said that some big school football players at Northwestern University qualify as revenue-producing employees of the school and are entitled to form a union. There's no direct tie to basketball yet, but the money made in top college sports could change if athletes are seen as workers rather than amateur unpaid dreamers filling the pockets of TV networks and big college athletic departments. Fortunately for the NCAA, there is no chance that our rival to the tournament will distract from the drive to the Elite Eight. Our voting continues apace, and you've been great, by the way, for the greatest TV characters of all time. In yesterday's bracket competition, Columbo went head-to-head against Archie Bunker from All in the Family. Columbo, as Archie might have said to Edith, got stifled big time.
You stifle yourself!
So Bunker moves on, and you can see the specific vote counts and all the other elimination results at thetakeaway.org as we get closer to crowning a champion best TV character of all time. Two more members of our staff and two more characters now. Let the games continue. Entering the arena to make the case for top-seeded Elaine Benes of Seinfeld and the more Cinderella long shot with solid public broadcasting creds, the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey.
Elaine Benes needs no introduction.
No, there's something else. An indefinable quality.
Grace?
Grace, yes.
You think I have grace?
Some grace, yes.
Elaine gave us iconic Seinfeld moments like Top of the Muffin to You, War, What Is It Good For?, Head to Toe No Funny Business, The Urban Sombrero, The Great Juji Fruit Incident of 1994, and unbridled enthusiasm.
Unbridled enthusiasm.
Yeah, that's right. That's what led to Billy Mumphrey's downfall.
I'd argue that Elaine's capacity for unbridled enthusiasm is what truly gave the show its life force. Unpredictable, perennially inventive Elaine is the show's secret ingredient.
You know, you doodle a couple of bears at a cocktail party talking about the stock market, you think you're doing comedy.
Actually, that's not bad.
Oh, really? Yes. You know, I have others.
Yada, yada, yada. Vote for Elaine Benes as TV's greatest character at thetakeaway.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present Violet Crawley. And please, park your American informalities at the door.
What should we call each other? Well, we could always start with Mrs. Crawley and Lady Grantham. I forbid it.
She is the Queen of Mean.
To have strange men prodding and prying around the house, to say nothing of pocketing the spoons.
A showstopper, a tour de force.
Osmond, there's no need to be so gleeful. You sound like Robespierre lopping off the head of Marie Antoinette.
Frankly, I dare you not to vote for the Dowager Countess of Grantham, the finest TV character played by the finest TV character actor.
Why does every day involve a fight with an American?
That's Takeaway Associate Producer Maithili Rao and Takeaway executive producer Rupert Allman. And perhaps it's not fair to have a real Brit in cahoots with actress Maggie Smith. I assure you, if Mythili wins this one, though, we've been told her job is safe. Sounds like a Downton Abbey plot, huh? Cast your ballot in today's Takeaway TV Brackets Battle at takeaway.org. Be sure to mention which characters you think were left out of our brackets contest while you're there. Tomorrow we'll hear Omar from The Wire take on Agent Dale Cooper of Twin Peaks, and Sybil Fawlty from Fawlty Towers takes on the Wilt Chamberlain of TV comedy, Lucy from I Love Lucy. Cast your votes at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
So who doesn't love and revere water, right? And all the special places where you can just stare at it.
My name is Tammy, and I'm a writer living in Manhattan. All winter long, I found myself thinking about Walden Pond in the summertime. I learned how to swim there as a kid, and I visit there whenever I possibly can. I still believe I do my best writing when I'm swimming across.
This is Andrea Fields. I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida. My favorite body of water has to be Hanama Bay on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. I remember as a toddler, my dad would take me out there with a snorkel, and I would cling to his white undershirt as he swam around the bay, and I could see all the underwater animals.
We're all in a crowd of water gazers, as Melville said a long time ago. One of you in San Antonio, Texas, gazes at a secret cove in St. Martin that makes me feel strong, like I'm the king of the universe. I used to swim out as far as I could before trying to touch the bottom. Here's an homage you can be a part of. On April 12th, 50 dancers in Miami and around 1,500 more from 30 states around the country will come together for a water dance to this music, a project to draw attention to water issues around the country. At exactly 4 p.m. Eastern Time, they all simultaneously begin to dance, performing dances crafted for their site at a river, a bay, a lake, ocean, any body of water nearby. Dale Andre is the founder and director of the National Water Dance, movement, she says, comes naturally to all of us humans.
We are predominantly water, so we move, we flow. That's part of who we are, and dance is about liberating that. So it's such a natural connection with water itself.
And the National Water Dance, which is what this is, how important is it, the collective piece, the idea that everyone would be doing something on a mass event scale at the same moment?
Well, I think that's exactly it. Being able to use the internet to connect like this and know that everybody is beginning a dance at exactly the same time with the same movement just has a much bigger voice, a more profound statement. And I think for the participants, it's definitely made an impression that they can be connected like this to all these dancers across the country.
How much preparation is required for someone who wants to participate? How much is, you know, really choreographed, and how much will be improv?
It all depends. At our site, we've been working on this since late fall, and our part is choreographed, but at some sites, it'll be more improvised. We are sharing some movement gestures. We collected them via the internet and posted them on the website. So, like I said, we're all beginning with the same gesture and coming to an end with the same gesture. They can improvise. They can do what they want. And inspired by the site, so that has a lot to do with it as well.
What sites do you hope are represented, depending on the level of participation? I mean, you have yours in Florida, and, you know, there's some obvious bodies of water around North America, you could imagine, including the Great Lakes, but this could be as small as a little pond.
Oh, absolutely. And we didn't want to discourage anyone who might be working with a school where they couldn't go on site. I mean, we have water coming out of water fountains, and I think that's valid too. But for the most part, everybody is at natural sites.
Is there a collective awareness of water that you're shooting for, and what would that be?
Well, on the most basic level, it's simply looking to encourage a water ethic. I think that the problems we're facing with water are serious and profound across the country, and each one of our locations has an emphasis on what's important to that locale. But there's an overarching theme of a water ethic. We all can, this very moment, change the way we use water, what we're aware of, and hopefully that would grow into something of a larger involvement.
If the narrative right now in terms of a national water crisis in places like California and the West is about drought and scarcity, what's the narrative in Florida?
Well, there are many, but where we are, particularly on Biscayne Bay and the Deering Estate, we're dealing directly with saltwater intrusion and looking at rehydration of wetlands to keep that balance, because that will affect the aquifer and our drinking water, and that's an immediate concern.
Well, Dale, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this.
You can find a list of live National Water Dance sites at se.nationalwaterdance.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So while all those billionaires in Russia worry about how to protect their riches from sanctions, how do the rest of us get a shot at pitching ideas to the oligarchs anywhere in the world? Sure, maybe you occasionally spot the limo with the armed escort zipping down your streets or see the super yacht parked out in the harbor, but you can't exactly paddle out to the billionaire's boat and, hey, I've got this new invention, or pitch your brilliant philanthropic idea or your hot startup company. You could, but you'd probably just end up getting wet. What if you had a GPS map, though, of the richest people in the world, knew where they were, knew where they might see eye to eye with you? There is something to help you navigate these waters. Its inventors call it relationship science, or RELSI. It's a database of more than 3 million people. You might just call it a monster Rolodex, but then you would just reveal how old school and low tech you are if you said something like that. Neil Goldman and Greg Lindsay are with us. Greg Lindsay writes about relationship science in the latest issue of Inc. magazine, and Neil Goldman is chairman and CEO of Relationship Science. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
So, Neil, what do you attribute the enthusiasm of investors to this RELSI concept?
First, I just would clarify, you know, people have referred to us as a Rolodex for the 1%, and I think that's just because it's a sexy term. You know, our product is not that. It currently covers 3.5 million people, which is everyone, who's lots of people who do business at every level. So it's not
that.
Well,
let me sharpen the metaphor. I mean, in a sense, a Rolodex is just a bunch of names, but in the case of you, it's not really about the neurons in this list. It's about the connections, the
right.
Synapses. Explain how that works.
Sure. So we basically have tracked down a certain type of people who make decisions in the primarily business and nonprofit world. And we map them out, and who knows them, in a very detailed graph. And so what we do is we allow all types of people, even especially nonprofits, who's a big segment, to figure out how they can best approach or get to someone who could help push their mission forward, whatever that is, for-profit or nonprofit.
And to get to Neil Goldman was the mission of your article in Inc. Did the magazine pay for the subscription fee, sign up, or anything like
they
that?
They were nice enough to give me a trial for that one. But no, it was interesting. When I started out, when I was meeting Neil for the first time at Penn Station, you know, I decided I'd use his own software against him, which is this notion of who do I know that's connected to him? And so, of course, we have a friend in common, a friend who's friends with so many people. And, you know, it was interesting because I could go up to him and say, hey, Neil, my friend Parag sends his regards. I could fake the introduction. And this sort of carried through the whole piece. What Neil pointed out at the end when I finally confessed that I'd pulled this ruse off against him is that all I had to say was that we had a friend in common, right? I mean, so many of the connections that we have can just be bound together by the people that we know. We can create this familiarity if we simply say, you know, we have this friend. And suddenly, instead of two strangers talking, you're now bound together and you could actually have a real relationship and talk eye to eye.
Well, RELSI is the latest slogan to meet BizDev, business development. How does a business use your product to actually increase the likelihood that they will find somebody who can help them, work with them, collaborate with them?
Sure, and I'd put in a bigger context of relationship capital management, right? One of the biggest underutilized assets that firms have is our relationships. And I don't even know who I know because they might have changed jobs and they might be taking on additional extracurricular responsibilities. So first is, how do you aggregate who we know and who they know, which is almost impossible to figure out? And then you basically take a business objective, and then you can now map out who should we perhaps ask for that introduction, or when I have that meeting, how am I best prepared to have that warm introduction?
And so if I paid $9,000 as a business to sign up for your program and Warren Buffett was my destination, you could map out some sort of way for me conceivably to get there.
Sure, but you know, the Warren Buffett example could be, it's like I need to meet a mid-level person at a corporation. It's not all about the
1%. Right. It's not all about the 1%. It's not all about the top of the pyramid.
Exactly.
All right. So if this actually works, it's an extraordinary updating problem for you as a business, because all of a sudden two friends could become mortal enemies. And if you miss that, you've kind of wrecked it.
Well, two parts to that. I mean, that's what we do. And our background as a company, and we have 600 people, is large-scale updating of data. So, you know, if someone has changed roles, we have that, and that's our business. With regard to the qualitative aspect of, is someone a friend or a foe, we don't track that. We track the likelihood of people knowing each other, because that's we only know it's public, and a lot of that friend-foe stuff is private. So we can't possibly collect that data.
So as a journalist, how do you evaluate objectively the value of this experience? Is it just interesting curiosity, or do you think it actually has value and a game changer?
Well, the first time I looked at RealSci, I felt like I was lifting the curtain back on reality. You know, I thought of like C. Wright Mills, a sociologist who wrote The Power Elite, because the first time you could really see how the 1%, apologies, Neil, is really connected that way. And, you know, but to me, it's more of a harbinger of one future of social networks. You know, I mean, we tend to conflate social media and social networks. Like, social networks are not just Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Wherever there are two people, there's a social network in the real world. And there's a whole body of academic research on this to show that this is how ideas are transmitted. This is where innovation comes from, when you bring together the right combination of people at the right time and the right place. And you never know who those people are. And tools like RealSci you can start mining these connections. You can start looking for these sort of buried connections between people, and you can actually bring them to the surface. You know, if big data is the new oil, then this is the equivalent of fracking, right? You are now extracting value that you knew was there, but you've never had a chance to get at it. And I'm really interested to see how it evolves, because services like RealSci, you know, you can put them on Google Glass. You could put them on your cell phone. You can use it when you're meeting people in the world to figure out, how do I know this person? How do I make the right introduction? It's a way to get away from the screen or the VR goggles that Facebook wants to use for social networks and bring it out into the real world.
And to just hit the point again of, it's not the 1%, his Parag Khanna example, that would mean you're the 1% if you're in there. So
it's the value of any relationship, no matter how much money they have, mined from big databases like you're constructing.
And I'll give you a very big idea. You know, the Industrial Revolution is, how do you make a widget faster? Today, it's a service economy and everyone's got a supercomputer in their pocket. So how do you create a little more efficiency and for everyone? And mining these relationships that are this hidden tremendous value is what we're trying to help everybody do.
The premise of relationship science. Neil Goldman is chairman and CEO of RealSci. Greg Lindsay is contributing writer for Inc. magazine. He writes about relationship science in the latest issue of the magazine. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Noah. You know, it's that old man meets God, God says build a boat story from the Bible.
This all belongs to me. This land, this forest, that stronghold of yours. Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
Then what is it?
An ark. To hold the innocent when the Creator sends his deluge to wipe out the wicked from this world.
This weekend, the big water story Noah hits the big screen. Russell Crowe, that gladiator, gets a chance to captain a larger boat than he did in Master and Commander. And this film is expected to do better than both of those. It's got the Bible going for it, right? Lately, Sunday school has been taking over the weekend. Have you noticed? Noah is the second big biblical film in the past few weeks. Last month, Son of God was released, produced by Mark Burnett, the creator of Survivor. Gotta love that, right? There are more Bible picks to come this year. Hollywood loves the Bible. Not so much the begats and discussions of which foods to avoid, but the more exciting bits. Floods, fires, crucifixions, plagues of frogs, evil Romans. Hollywood goes nuts for that kind of stuff. A good thing? Not so much. Heresy? Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, and Krista Tippett, the host of On Being, both say that Hollywood's major mistake is when it loses sight of the story and tries to get the Bible right on screen.
I'm afraid to say that what is accomplished every time is that they take stories which are rich with nuance and meaning between the lines and make them more literal and more flat than they in fact are in the biblical text.
Rafer, is Hollywood of today going for a kind of special effects, get closer to Jesus, get closer to God, kind of hyper-realistic sort of experience? Or is there something about the big ideas of the Bible that attracts Hollywood?
I think it depends on what movie you're talking about. The two that we're seeing now are very different. Son of God is a very literal, straightforward interpretation of the story of Jesus. It was made by committee. You know, essentially they ran the text of the script and everything by religious leaders and by the Anti-Defamation League, by everyone, to make sure that they weren't going to offend anyone and it was going to be safe, by-the-book version
Sounds
of the Jesus story.
Really entertaining.
Yeah, well.
That's right.
But it has done well at the box office. But I think Noah is going to be a very different case. One thing that's caused a lot of controversy around the film is that people feel that maybe it's taking too many liberties with the biblical text and perhaps being too interpretive. So, you know, we'll see how it plays.
But isn't there an attraction to the Noah story like there was to the Ten Commandments? You know, you create this parting of the Red Sea thing. I mean, Otto Preminger and those big directors of the golden age of Hollywood couldn't resist the Bible.
Sure. I think when you're talking about the Old Testament, you always want spectacle. And I think Noah is going to deliver on that. What it looks like so far is something like an action fantasy with kind of otherworldly type creatures. Clearly, the flood scenes look very spectacular. The ark itself looks pretty amazing. So I think they're definitely going for that kind of old school spectacle, at least in some way.
So what would you say, Krista, Hollywood is after when they go for the Bible? Are they just recycling another kind of, you know, fertile field of content? Or do they have a bigger mission in the experiences you've had seeing biblical-based movies?
I think what Hollywood goes for, and I really don't want to question anybody's motivations, I think the motivations are probably all across the board, including really honorable and really wanting to honor the text. But the truth is, it is absolutely interpretive. For example, just for starters, if you take the story of Noah, there is no dialogue. Noah does not say a single word in the entire story. So just in the act of creating words, it is interpreted and in some ways framed and narrowed the story according to somebody's vision.
What about Passion of the Christ, which is 10 years old? The Mel Gibson, you know, controversy that attracted, you know, fueled weeks of programming on Fox News. And did the whole Jesus was killed by the Jews story. Where does that stand in all these other movies that we've been talking about, Krista?
Jesus was a Jew, right? And a lot of what's going on in the biblical story and in the New Testament is about this very complicated relationship between Jews and Judaism and Jesus and this new faith that's emerging. But in the act of extracting the characters and the narrative to make it into a movie, you just can't preserve that kind of nuance and that kind of tension behind the scenes. So I'm not saying it can be a good movie. I mean, I honestly don't think that the Bible is a safe text. So I would say a movie that's not completely safe is probably somewhat more faithful to the spirit of the text than something that's safe.
You know, I think some of the best movies about the Bible take some of the little stories, like Barabbas, for instance, part of the Easter story, or The Robe, which is a kind of apocryphal story, but it is pieced together with stuff related to Easter. Do you have any favorites?
I'm not a big Bible story movie person. I would love to see some good TV about biblical stories, you know, because TV is becoming the medium where you can really do character development and the kind of hero, anti-hero, you know, telling life as it is and not how we want it to be, which is what movies give us, what we want life to be. But TV is getting good at telling life as it is.
Hmm. Jerusalem Abbey, Homeland, the Galilee stories. What are your favorites, Rafer?
I would have to go, reaching quite a ways back, I would have to go with Jesus Christ Superstar, which I really thought was a really interesting interpretation of the Jesus story. And somehow, I don't remember a great deal of controversy over that. I don't quite know why. You would think it would be a little heretical, but it seemed to please people. And I think it got to the heart of Jesus as a cult of personality. I really loved that movie.
What do you make?
I did too.
What about a movie like Ghost? Is that getting into some sort of territory that's quasi-religious, or is that just pure kind of tabloid crap?
I mean, I think the supernatural, the idea of the afterlife seems really powerful and very reassuring to people. I think people like the idea of a heaven and a hell. Remember, there was both a heaven and a hell in Ghost. That's kind of important.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think people like that. There's a movie coming out soon called Heaven Is For Real, based on a true story of a little boy who goes into emergency surgery, dies briefly, and comes back knowing all these things he couldn't possibly know because he has been to heaven and seen God. We'll see how that film plays out as well.
And I suspect, Krista, Resurrection on ABC is not finding its way into your DNA.
Actually, it's on my list and I haven't watched it yet. But I'll tell you, some shows that I really love are like Alan Ball's shows, True Blood, 6 Feet Under. Now, those are not about biblical stories. And, I do have a certain liking for vampires. But the thing is, those kinds of shows also take on mortality. And they do it in a dramatic way that in some ways is imaginative and more like what the Bible does with things in some ways. But also they take on spiritual things, I think, about the other, right, and how we relate to difference.
Well, I'm thinking here, if you took Game of Thrones and combined it with Kung Fu, you could do the Divine Comedy, two guys wandering through Inferno.
There's your tagline for the poster right there.
Oh, man. Well, Noah will have to sit in that pantheon as we think about the movies that are literally related to the Bible. Krista Tippett, host of On Being, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And Rafer Guzman, don't get on any arcs in the rain, okay, buddy?
I'll try not to. Thank you.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Krista Tippett loves vampires. Are we burying the lead? Wade in the waters, the Bible says. We'll leave you with one of your favorite bodies of water.
Bill Wick from Fort Worth, Texas. My favorite body of water, that's Lake Ray Hubbard. It was the closest body of water to where I lived during some of my best teenage years, but most importantly, it was the site of my very first overnight camp out with no adults. It was just me and four buddies from school.
Your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.